Hey, welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. You know the drill. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor. Make sense out of the senseless. If at all possible, find the obvious, bear to the absurd. Hold on to your lug nuts, kids. Time for an overall. Again, cranking it up one more time from the vaunted and highly respected Aurora Media Studios, just outside of the windy city of Chicago, Illinois. So wherever you're listening, welcome, welcome, welcome. And I'm not kidding about listening around the world. I got a Facebook message last week from a listener in Brussels. I'm sure it was in reference to my Brussels sprouts that they checked and let me know that they were in Brussels, but I sure appreciate it. It's amazing to me, really. And I never want it to not be amazing to me. When people check in from parts known and parts unknown to me, I get the biggest kick out of it. It's like writing the books that I've written in my life. I have three of my own, Living an Uncommon Life, Every Moment Matters, and Phenomenon. And I don't know where they go once I've done my end of it, which is writing the books and getting them published and all like that. And, you know, I'm still getting, for lack of a better term, fan mail from Living an Uncommon Life, which came out in 2007. Now it's evergreen content. It's written that way specifically, so it's not time sensitive. And at any moment, the light bulb of consciousness goes off in somebody's life. They go, oh my God, I'd never heard this before. The truth is, in my opinion, observation and my experience, there's not a lot new anymore. I mean, we come upon a discovery that we didn't know about previously. We go, oh my gosh, this is groundbreaking. Yeah, but somebody already did it 2 weeks earlier or 2 years earlier or 20 years earlier. So when I was a kid, reading books that kind of pushed my consciousness in a direction that I didn't even know I was going at that point, exposed me to literature and teachings and lessons and authors that I found, you know, instrumental and profound in my life and still do. I remember years and years and years ago, you know, again, this is just for me. I do what you want with it, but I'm just kind of following the track of the show here so far. I was given a cassette tape by a guy in Madison, Wisconsin. And all it said on there was Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. Didn't mean anything to me, just a cassette, threw it in a box. 5 years later, 4 or 5 years later, I came across it. I'm like, oh, what is this? Well, the cassette hadn't changed, and the title of the cassette had not changed, but something in my brain went, oh, listen to this. And it is one of those pieces of literature. I think there's 4 or 5 volumes of this series, about a guy who, a group of scientists, I should say, who went on expedition back in the 1800s to Nepal and Tibet and the Far East and things like that. And the supposed setup is that they ran into these masters who overlook humanity. Is it true? I don't know. What is and what isn't true is in the mind of the beholder. But it was so profound to me to read something different than I had grown up with, let's put it that way, as far as spiritual matters. And it really pushed me. I thought, this is just, you know, I didn't take it as gospel, but I thought this is adding on to my toolbox here. And so, interestingly enough, I listened to that probably, I couldn't get enough of it, 20 times. And then maybe a couple years later, we were living in Michigan, and we were taking a trip from the UP to Arkansas, I believe. A bunch of guys were going down to Native American friends of mine going to this big event, and I tagged along. And I got in the guy's van, who's driving, longtime friend, and we're heading down to Arkansas. It's a long drive, I'm here to tell you, and especially when he was driving, he drives like 50 miles an hour. So at one point, I'm sitting behind the driver's seat in the path, you know, behind him in the second row, and my foot's pushing on something under the seat. I'm like, what is this? I got to get this out of the way if I'm going to be in this van for so long. And it turned out to be a copy in print of the Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. And I thought, geez Louise. So that kind of kicked me off into this journey of finding things that, you know, and considering things that I never would have considered before, to be open my mind to things that gave rise to possibilities. And then I could weigh them out myself, whether or not they work for me or they don't. And that particular group of books, I still have a coveted first edition sitting here. I was able to have that, and the audiobook on that old beat up cassette tape, the audio version, I should say. I don't know who the narrator was, but he was fantastic. The guy that wrote the book was Baird T. Spaulding. Is that not a great 18th, maybe 19th century name? Baird T. Spaulding. And so every now and again, when the world gets tight on the outside, I will turn to those books and think of things that were passed along. And again, whether or not they're true or they happened or didn't happen, I'm kind of like on the fence on that. It's like when I found out that my favorite, or I should say one of my favorite authors, but he's got to be right to the top, John Steinbeck, fudged on parts of a book called Travels with Charlie. And that to me was the best thing that Steinbeck ever wrote, because it was about his life. It wasn't a fictional story, supposedly. And that he had this pickup truck with the camper on the back. He had this giant poodle named Charlie. And he was coming into his final time on the planet, Mr. Steinbeck was, and he wanted to see America. So he took off, and I loved the book, loved the book. And come to find out years later, there were scenes that he made up based on something he saw, I'm sure, but they never actually happened. So, you know, the line can get pretty thin now and again, and then a little hazy here and there. And I put down Steinbeck's book for about 2 years. I was pissed. How could he do that? Well, then you start to take literary license with things, and John Steinbeck, of course, being a writer of fiction, I could see why his mind would say, here's what I'm looking at. You know, I'm parked at this campground. I went fishing for a couple hours. I saw this man and his daughter pull up, and this is what happened, this conversation they had. Now, whether the conversation happened or not, I don't know, but there was value in it. So I've tried to be more inclusive in information and dig through things to see if they fit for me, and if they don't, you know, they're just kind of put off to the side. But that's a little different than dismissing science, let's say. And I'm a science guy. I've loved science since I was in fifth grade. Thank you, Mr. Andler. And I just, I was enamored with it. I just thought, this is the cool, how could we know so much stuff? And then I'd soak that up. And to this day, you know, when something scientific comes along, and are they breakthroughs? I don't know anymore. I mean, everything seems so quick now. But every now and again, I'll read about something or hear something, and like we've done this. Technology obviously is far past humanity. We're so far behind our own technology, it's not even funny. So when there is a breakthrough, not technically in the world, I don't even talk about new cell phones or anything, but when a scientific thing comes along and it gets people kind of energized, I like that. I think we need things that are not manufactured by ourselves all the time. And case in point, in just a couple of days, is the solar eclipse. And people are already, you know, kind of freaking out. I don't know if they're freaking out about it, but, you know, you hear these things about, you know, what solar eclipses are all about. And it's obviously something that's been going on for billions of years. And in this century, I can't remember where I read it. I think I found a list. There was, in the 21st century, there will be 224 solar eclipses, 77 of which will be partial, 72 annular, 68 total eclipses, and 7s will be hybrids between total and annular eclipses. Of these, 2 annular and 1 total eclipse will be non-central. So what all that really means is the ones that are really cool are the 68 total eclipse of the sun. And I like to think and wonder if we went back 250, 500 years, 1,000 years, what humans on the planet at that time must have been trying to figure out when all of a sudden there's an eclipse, which they didn't even know what it was called. It was just the moon thing going on, and next thing you know, the sun is blotted out. And you can understand from the consciousness at that point of why they thought, oh boy, this is the end of the world. And all of a sudden it's not. Hey, wait a minute, we're still here. So on Monday, you know, people are already scrambling. And matter of fact, I already have my solar eclipse glasses from the last time it was a big deal. I came across the video. I'm like, this is perfect. I can look at it and it's all good. But there are some solar eclipse myths that are out there that you should know about, and they're not true. And it just once again shows to me that, you know, I mean, there's a group of people in India that think washing their hair with cow urine is a good thing. Now, I don't think that so much, but that's what they believe. And so myths are really beliefs that have expanded, and a certain amount of people, you know, dig into that, and they become something I got to talk about on a podcast. The first myth is that those who are pregnant should never watch an eclipse because it can harm your baby. But according to NASA, an eclipse will not harm pregnant women or their fetuses. The U.S. Space Agency said that the myth stems from a false idea that the sun emits harmful radiation during an eclipse. Wrong. Every second, your body is being pelted by trillions of these neutrinos from the sun, no matter if the sun is above or below the horizon. And it's just part of being alive on the planet, so that's not true. Another myth, eclipses will poison your food. Along with the other fears focused on solar rays during an eclipse, NASA notes another falsehood claiming that radiation will harm your food. The basic idea is that the total eclipses are terrifying, so it's natural to want to make up fearful stories about them and look for coincidences among the events around you. So eclipses will poison your food, but let's microwave the shit out of them. That's okay. And here's the myth that ties into this blindness thing. It's completely safe to stare at eclipse. I just brought this up. Staring at an eclipse without adequate eye protection is stupid, and it can cause retinal damage and severe eye injury. You'll need solar eclipse viewing glasses to observe it. I'll sell you mine for $400. Several U.S. retailers and entities, including Warby Parker, My Doctor Eye, Smoothie King, and Sonic, are giving away these glasses for free. Pretty good marketing move. So that's on April 8th. And here in the States, you know, depending on where you live, of course, you'll see all of it, or 10% of it, or 12% of it, or 80% of it, or whatever. And what I like most about eclipse is that it's something we have no control over, much like the weather. And it's a humbling experience to me. This is how I kind of look at the totality of life on Earth. Dinosaurs were literally taken out, wiped out, after millions of years of existence. Millions of years of existence. On the same planet that we walk on, and people think we're somehow invincible. The bottom line is, we're not any better than a frickin' Stegosaurus. And the earthquakes in New York show this. There's an eclipse going on. I mean, this whole system is not in our control. And when we do things to mess with the things we do have control over in the system, it's stupid, in my opinion. So that leads me to this being Earth Month. It used to be just Earth Day. Then it was Earth Week. Now it's Earth Month. And that's right. I mean, every day is Earth Day. Got to get that right out. And I think of the things that we have control over, things we could do to lessen the impact that we have on the planet. And, you know, there's been some great advances. I don't want to paint this as a dire picture. There's been some great advances. If you'd have told me 10 years ago that every F-150 Ford pickup truck that rolls off the line now would be, you know, electric, come on. On the other hand, Henry Ford and Thomas Edison were wrangling about electric cars back in the day until, you know, that's easier to just do oil, which has made people billionaires. You don't get that kind of cash out of the solar system, right? You can't, it's not the same kind of incoming money and dependency on oil. So a lot of convoluted pieces there. But again, you know, there are things we can do in your own backyard. And one of the best efforts I've ever had in radio over the years is doing the Earth Matters series with my pal Bill Curtis. And this idea first came to me probably in 2008-09, somewhere in there. And I was working at Harpo, Oprah Radio, and I was creating these one-minute vignettes. And for some reason, much like writing books, which seems to be above my pay grade, but apparently isn't, I've been pretty adept at taking a lot of information and putting it in a one-minute slice, 59 seconds. And you need that extra half second on the front and the back to close the thing off. But anyway, that's just tech stuff. And I remember doing one for Dr. Oz. We called it Health Matters. Created one for Gene Chatsky, called it Money Matters. I was doing my own one-minute vignettes for years. I probably did, I don't know, 6,000 of these things. Seriously, from when I started radio till when I left Oprah Radio. Called Power Thoughts, those were a minute long. And I knew I wanted to do something environmentally, but I didn't know who to park it with. Meaning I already had my own. We didn't have anybody on the air at Harpo that could actually really, I thought, represent it in the way that it needed to be done. And one day Bill Curtis was coming in, of course, the highly respected and vaunted journalist from A&E and everything else. And he was either coming on to talk with Oz about tall grass beef, which is what he had at the time, grass-fed beef and the health benefits of that, or Gene to talk about the business. And one of the two he was in for. And this is a guy who, you know, I mean, he is all about the environment. And so much of the best work he's ever done, I remember he did a documentary called Earth in the Hot Seat back in 1999. And he went around the world literally for a year with a camera crew and just captured what was going on with climate change. And one of the most telling scenes in that documentary was when he was somewhere where there was supposedly permafrost. It's called permafrost because it's supposed to be altogether now permanent. It's been frozen as long as we've known it as humans on this planet. And the permafrost was melting because of climate change. Because it was warmer, the trees were changing. And because the trees were changing, there was some sort of bugs that were able to get to these trees and decimate them, which changed the whole food line behind them. Everything in nature is connected to something else. That is the one great lesson of the natural world. Everything is connected to something else. I'm sitting in my chair. I look out the yard every day, and I watch all the birds go at it with the feeder. I watch the squirrels do their thing. I watch, everything. They're all doing their thing. Now, outside of me giving them mealyworms for breakfast for my pals, the robins, they got to go out and feed on the bugs. No bugs, there's no feeder, right? There's everything is connected. They don't get the food they need, then they become, endangered to some degree. John Muir said it. If you tug on one thing in nature, everything gets pulled along with it. Something I've never forgotten, but I think we've forgotten in the big picture, that we are inextricably connected to the environment. Whether you think it's going on the other side of the world or not, at some point it affects you, some way, somehow. It may take a long time, but it's a ripple effect. Everything in life is a ripple effect. It's the old, Newton's third law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's science, folks. It's not myth. So I pulled Bill into my office. I said, hey, read these. And he read three or four of these one-minute things I had called Earth Matters. And, of course, I thought, this is perfect. Well, unfortunately, or fortunately at that time, I was getting ready to exit Harpo about 8 months later, so we never got him on the air there. Bill went back on television here in Chicago on the news with Walter Jacobson. If you're from Chicago, you know their team was pretty formidable back in the day. They were number one. So he had a contract, so we had to wait like till 2014, 13, 14 to do these. And I had forgotten about him. My pal John Keith, who was the production wizard of the planet, called me up one day after I'd been gone from Harpo probably a year or two. And he's like, what do you want me to do with these Earth things, bro? And I said, what are you talking about? So then he sent them to me, and I'm like, these are... And Johnny had gone and put production around them, and they were fantastic. So when Bill's contract was done with CBS and I was able to do it, I approached WCPT here in Chicago to air them, and they were all over because it's Bill Curtis, and it was great. Ended up writing 300 episodes of Earth Matters. I found the information was that important. I found I was able to take what appeared to be sometimes really important information you may not have heard before and distill it into a minute and then put Mr. Curtis in the booth to record him. And how can you ignore it? So this month, when I do these podcasts, I'm going to be inserting some of the Earth Matters episodes that we did a few years ago. They ran for 3 years in national syndication, online. Millions of people were able to be exposed to this in a good way. And I still have all of them, of course. And there's some talk, we'll see if it happens, about resurrecting them, because so much of this stuff, you need to hear it more than once. It is timeless, much like the books I've written. It's called Evergreen. A lot of these are still a problem. Some of the things they point out. So this particular one is always important. It's one of the first ones that we ever did, the first ones I ever wrote. It's all about the bees. And so this is Earth Matters with Bill Curtis.
There are at least 20,000 known species of bees in the world. But it's what we don't know about this amazing insect that might be one of the biggest challenges we face with regard to the environment in the next 20 years. A Cornell University study estimates that honeybees annually pollinate $14 billion worth of seeds and crops in the United States. Essentially, if honeybees disappear, they could take most of our insect-pollinated plants with them. The past 6 years have brought about a condition called CCD, or colony collapse disorder, an acceleration in the annual die-off of bees that some experts believe has to do with sprayed-on pesticides. While there are big problems when it comes to long-term sustainability, it might just turn out that the bee contains our greatest chance for survival. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
Yeah, so when I listen to that, I think about the process of producing those. So for every 1 minute that you just heard, for example, with the bees, it probably took me 2.5-3 hours to find the information, to put it in a certain way, to write for his voice. And I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 takes to get it done. So probably 3 hours for every minute, I'm going to just guess. And some took longer and some were a lot shorter. And when I listen to it now, literally that aired 10 years ago. When I listen to it now, the message is still the same. It has not changed. And I just have this deep sense, comes from a lot of influences. It comes from Theodore Roosevelt, comes from John Denver, comes from Jacques Cousteau. It comes from my mom, about being a steward of the planet, and most specifically, your yard, basically, your plot of land. Even if you're in an apartment listening to this and you have a little, you know, window garden or something, you know, there's something you can do, something you should be part of and understand that. My mom was such a huge influence in that. You know, we have a lot of plants and things like that and flowers in the house, and I tend to those on a really regular basis. And I'm almost over-tending. Part of me thinks the reason I do it so much is, you know, it's like this is an homage to my mom who had a serious green thumb. A big deal for me was to go to the, with her to the florist, and there was a greenhouse there. And, you know, I got to pick a plant or something, and I had to take care of that. Early stewardship lessons from my mom. And, of course, you know, you get into Teddy Roosevelt, who was the conservation president. You get into Jacques Cousteau, this underwater pioneer. I used to sit and watch the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau every Tuesday night at 6:30 on ABC forever. I mean, here I was a kid in Chicago, and you're able to go on this ship with these guys and go underwater. I mean, come on. So now that's nothing, right? I mean, you'd have to have shark attacks every 5 minutes for people to watch that. But back then in the 60s, it was such groundbreaking stuff because I'd never seen anything like that. It goes back to that shift of consciousness. I'd never seen anything like that. It's like going to the aquarium in Chicago, and I think they're changing it, but they had that undersea reef there. Right when you walked in, it was this huge reef, and there was a guy who would go in there and feed the fish, and there was a shark in there. It was a nurse shark. It wasn't a great white, but there was still a shark. And to see things you don't normally see, to me, has always given me a huge appreciation and curiosity for the world that I live in. And without that, I think we're screwed. You know, John Denver always said, the future of life on Earth depends on seeing the sacred where other people see the ordinary. That's true. I mean, my yard is fascinating to me. I walk around, see what kind of roly-polies are doing and what the birds are doing and even the stray cats who are chasing the mice are doing. I mean, it's ecology and environment unto itself. And understanding that, to me, has given this great, like, lordship over this place to take care of it on my watch. And I think, I mean, I can tell you right now, in Chicago, when you see these brick bungalows, for example, all lined up and you see these yards out in front, these square plots of grass, it is some of the greenest, most beautifully trimmed, well-preserved grass on the planet. These people are so proud of their front lawns. And I'm assuming it's the backyard too. I mean, they take care of that, but it's kind of your showpiece up front. Imagine having that mindset in totality about the planet, that it's all just one big lawn and we're all here to take care of it in the best way that we can. I get that everybody feels this way. I get that everybody agrees with me. I don't give a shit. It's my show. I can say what I want. And this is my stance on things. You know, that Earth in the Hot Seat documentary, which you can find online, I'm sure, was a profound piece for me to be involved with Bill. And I'll tell you why. Showed me exactly where things are at. Even back in 2009, which seems like, you know, a million years ago at this point. I'm sorry, it was 1999, not 2009. Now, even further back, it's the Jurassic Park area back in 1999. When the film finished, there was, I don't know, 500-600 people at Northern Michigan University where we showed the film. And I was moderating it, and Bill was my guest. And we get up, and is there any questions? And the first guy stands up and says, Mr. Curtis, I love you on Cold Case Files, and I love you on A&E, but I think you're just full of crap here. He says, I have not seen any of what you've promoted on this film in Upper Michigan, and I've been out in the woods for 40 years. So I think it's kind of just a liberal agenda that you got going here. But you know, you should just stick doing crime shows. And Bill says, thank you. Next question. And the guy just stood there like he's waiting to get into a verbal dodge and parry with Mr. Curtis. Didn't happen. He acknowledged it by saying thank you and said next question. That was the end of it. And I'm on the other side of the fence going, all right, let's go toe-to-toe, brother. I'm ready to take you on. Huge lesson for me. The next person stands up, and it's a young woman. And she says, Mr. Curtis, I watch you all the time on television. I have three little children. I'm highly concerned about the future. What can I do? And to me, there it was. This is basically the two camps that we spend time in, no matter what the subject is. It's all bullshit. It's an agenda. You're trying to screw me over for some reason. Tell me more. How do I make a difference? Kind of the way it's... And there's a slice down the middle where people kind of waver back and forth. But that told me so much. They both watched the same documentary. They both came away with different opinions. And those differing opinions are good to have, especially if you can find middle ground, which gets smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, I'm going to do everything in my power to not get involved in all that's going on politically in the next few months, but it's going to become, you know, a great reality show, which we obviously love here in the United States. It's the world will watch another great reality show, our political, you know, shenanigans, for lack of a better term. And the reason I try to stay out of that so much is I can't do anything about it. All I can do is voice opinion one way or the other, which doesn't change a thing. So the longer I'm around, the more I'm involved in things that change things, that make things different. For example, 2 weeks ago, we had our, as I've mentioned, we've had our big bulldog bash for Schurz High School, and it raised a lot of money. And that's the theory. We got the money in the bank, we're going to help kids at some point. And I had probably three or four people that sent me notes after the fact saying, this is all great and well what you do, but, you know, they're not my kids, and the Chicago Public Schools should be taking care of this, and blah, blah, blah. I don't even answer that stuff. And the reason I don't is because it wasn't changing anything. I'm not going to get into it. Somebody I don't even know and has this opinion. And I'm not going to spend time there. What I'm going to spend time doing is being involved in the solution. Now, should the Chicago Public Schools fund everything? How the F do I know? I don't know that. I'm not in it. I don't know. Don't care, quite frankly. So they got this theory over here that the schools should take care of every single thing. Maybe that's how it was 50 years ago, but it's certainly not that now. So instead of getting into a tug of war about what the Chicago Public Schools should or shouldn't do, if kids are better than they were back, it's just all mouth candy. It's just verbal defecation. It comes to nothing. So this past week, we were able to put in action the very thing we talk about, which is making a difference. So Wednesday afternoon, I come to find out through just different channels and social media stuff from the school that the baseball team was putting up what's called Donor's Choice, and it's like a fundraising site where you can help teachers and things like that to do the things they need to do, coaches, whatever, and that they needed three baseball gloves for the baseball team. Now, these are going to mostly low-income kids. It's not like it was when I grew up, I guess. You know, you go out and buy a glove and you have it for 35 years. I still have two of them in my office. They needed a catcher's mitt. They needed a fielder's glove and an outfielder's glove. Each one of those mitts cost $300. Brand new, A2000s, top of the line. They'll last 10 years. So the amount, there's a couple donations came in. So it was basically $1,000 what they needed. And a couple of donations came in, and I think by the time we found out about it, it was like $800 was left. So our team got together, said, what do you want to do? Okay, let's do it. So we donated $1,000, bought the three gloves, and they'll have $187 left over to do whatever they need to do. Maybe it's baseballs or something, shin guards, who knows, you know, for the season. So on a micro level, not a macro level, where everybody argues about how it should be different but don't do anything, on a micro level, we had this fundraiser, alumni came together, they made donations. The minute they walked in the door, they made a donation. They bought raffle tickets and 50-50 raffles and all that kind of stuff. And we were able to take those dollars and move them over and put mitts and gloves in the hands of the baseball players. Problem solved. Now, that is a small example, but it's an important example in my opinion. That's how things can change. Just that little thing there. So, yeah, I could jump on the bandwagon and go to the Chicago Public Schools. Screw that. There's no time for that. What there's time for is solutions. And so when it comes to environmental things, I'm finding myself constantly looking for that. What do I do next? You know, what do we do here? It's like I read the last week that you really shouldn't cut your grass until after Mother's Day, because all the little creepy crawlers and the bugs and the things that are in the ground, they need a little bit more time, a little bit more time to come into their own and be part of the system. Sure enough, 2 days ago, there's a guy out front. It's 42 degrees out. He's cutting his grass. There's no grass to cut. He's chopping away anyway. So when it comes to stewardship, I think we have to be a little bit more informed. And that's our job to do that. You know, Mr. Andler's science class has never ended for me. It's pushed me forward for a lot of things. And I'm so grateful for that. So when I hear these debates about climate change, and I don't, that's like when the cigarette company said, smoking does not cause cancer. Is that a fact? And now on every pack of cigarettes, there's a disclaimer, smoking causes cancer. But for decades, it didn't, because there's money in it. And to me, it's no different on this end of things. You know, I don't care if you believe in climate change or anything like global warming, it doesn't matter. You're part of the system. The system is going to do what it's going to do, and you'll be in it and affected one way or another. That's the fact. Last thing I want to leave you with is something that really very cool happened yesterday in a different direction, but I just want to share it because so many of you that listen are part of this. The Randy Hundley book, Iron Man, came out last September. I worked on it for a year and a half with Randy, and I had lunch with him yesterday, and he's holding his own. He's a tough guy. And I wanted to share with him and share this with you as well about a text message I got the other day. So for me, this book in particular had three major benchmarks to it. Like, writing the book is one thing. It's not for the faint of heart, that's for sure. And I take that very seriously. I don't take myself real serious. That stuff I take pretty serious. So I had to get it right for him. That was kind of the first thing that if I got that right, then I felt like I could sleep at night going, I think I got this where it needs to be. I'm good with it. But the first benchmark would have been that the Cub fans would accept it. They are some of the most ardent and articulate fans in baseball. They know their history, especially those guys in the 1969 team and the 1984 championship team, and of course the 2016 World Series team. So I had to have all the information there, so that would be the first benchmark. And that has passed with flying colors. I still get, and it should be, the book's brand new basically. You know, people checking in that bought it, and they just loved the book. It takes them back to a time when what mattered most was going to a Cubs game. Simplicity. The second benchmark was the media. I've been in the media a long time. I have friends in the media, obviously. I have people who are in radio and print and television. And I sent out a few books to people. Some were for specific media coverage, and some were just to have it, to enjoy it. One of the books I sent to my friend Rick Kogan, who was incredibly talented and legendary columnist at the Chicago Tribune. He's written 8 books of his own, and this guy cuts no slack. If the book was bullshit, he would privately say, John, this is bullshit, can't help you. But he did not do that. He wrote a 3-page article that ran in the Tribune, and we sold a lot of books from that. So that passed muster on that one. But there was one more benchmark for me. There's a guy named Pat Jordan. And Pat Jordan, to me, is the best sports writer in America. You may not have heard of him, and that's okay, but you should go look up his stuff if you're interested in sports and baseball and things. And Pat Jordan wrote a book called A False Spring about his making his way in the minor leagues in baseball, getting injured, and kind of coming into his own as a young man. He never got to the major leagues. And that book is number 37 on the top 100 sports books of all time, in the same listing with Jerry Kramer's Instant Replay. And so Pat Jordan, to me, is the gold standard of writing, and especially sports writing. And since I'm not a sports writer per se, but I did this with Randy because, you know, I'm close enough to the subject to be able to pull it off, I thought, you know, I need to get a copy to Pat Jordan. It's a huge risk for me, kids, because a little bit like Kogan, if I don't hear back from the guy, I know it's a shit. It just didn't measure up, and that'd be okay, but it wouldn't. So his wife, Susie Jordan, and I have known each other for since the early days of radio, and I asked if I could send a book to Pat. She said, sure. He said, send it. So I sent one about 4 months ago. It never got there for some reason, and I'm like, okay. And I'm going to take that as a sign from the Almighty that I should just leave it alone so I don't get my ass handed to me by Pat Jordan in a literary sense. And I thought, no, screw it. I'm going to send it. So I sent it again. I just come out of the bank or the bakery or the butcher shop or something with a bee last Thursday, and this text message pops up from Susie. And she says, this is from Pat, because he never texts, so I'm doing it for him, that he loved the book, that it was recapturing a time in baseball that is rapidly being lost and swallowed up to the game as it is today. He, of course, knows who Randy Hundley is because of his exploits as a Cubs catcher. Now, Pat wrote a book called Tom Seaver and Me about his relationship with Tom Seaver, the great pitcher for the New York Mets, not unlike the relationship I've had with Randy for the same amount of time, about 30 years. So he was just very complimentary about the book. And he says, I hope you sell 1 million copies. The book is that good. Wow. It almost had me in tears. And I think the reason for that is when you put your back, at least for me, when I put my back into something that's far bigger than me, and that is makes me stretch, like writing makes me stretch. Like I have another book coming up, getting started again, a very 180 degree, you know, direction. But these things stretch me to represent something that's not there until I start typing. It's just so humbling to me and so fascinating to me. When I do writer's workshops, that's the main thing I attempt to get across. It's all the rest stuff you can figure out. How to get published, agents, that's nothing. You know what's something? It's getting something from nothing. That's where it all begins. So when I got that from Pat Jordan, it just made my week. I'm here to tell you. So for all of you who have bought the book and reviewed the book and sent me great messages, I just want to say thank you so much. You know, we have some more PR stuff coming up, and you know, these books take on a life of their own. I did my job. We put our best foot forward. And when I went to lunch with Randy yesterday and told about it, he's a very down home, humble guy, kind of, yep. He says, you know, I always wanted to do this. I never thought it would happen. And look how many people enjoy the book now and how it's kind of touched their lives. That's the magic of life, folks, at least for me. Get ready to send you off this week. I can't not talk about Jacques Cousteau and not include John's Calypso. It's just a stirring sea shanty. He used to close up most of his concerts with it, because I think it took him about 2 hours of all the other songs to get his voice broken into the point where he could hit these high notes. And this is one of my favorite versions of it. It's from a concert in Cedar Rapids many, many years ago, but it's just John and his 12-string, which is not what he normally would use when he did this song. And I just think it's one of those things that reminds me of the magic of life, taking something from nothing. His experience of being on the Calypso with Captain Cousteau gave birth to the song. It went to number one. For years and years and years, he donated all the royalties to the Cousteau Society. It was millions of dollars. And to me, that's kind of the highest use of your talent right there. So until next time, be well. Safe travels. Keep the faith.
Sail on a dream, on a crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown, to be part of the movement and part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. I Calypso, the places you've been to, things that you've shown us, the stories you tell. I Calypso, I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. Like the dolphin who guides you, you bring us beside you to light up the darkness in and show us the way. For though we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide and free as a wind swell, joyful and loving in letting it be.
Thank you, everybody.